Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Welcome to Webcology. Webcology is the show that takes you into the deepest and darkest ends of the ecosystem on the internet. Our guides will take you on a journey into web marketing and bring you the experts and the information so that you can further explore the web marketing world. Now, here are the hosts of Webcology, Jim Hedger and Dave Davies.
Hey everyone, welcome to Webcology on WMR.FM. It is the... What day is it? Oh, man, it is the 18th of November, 2021. This is Jim Hedger from Digital Always Media and Dave Davies from Beanstalk Internet Marketing. And time is flying so fast that it is Cyber Monday, like 10 days from now.
Yeah.
I'm blown away. I mean, like, we've been living at a time for the last, I don't know, for the last 21 months during the pandemic, but this autumn has just passed by so quickly. Next week is Thanksgiving. One of the things I'm thankful for is we're not going to be here. We get like a great 4-day weekend. Well, we're not going to be here live. We actually are going to be here because the other day, I don't know if friends saw this on Twitter or on Facebook. The other day, Dave and I had the privilege to interview Middle Gandhi and Mark Traphagen from SEO Clarity about the 59-page study they released earlier this month. And that was a really fun conversation.
It is. I'm going to like hold back on saying anything because listeners just need to like tune in because they like it was such an awesome interview. And I'm glad we actually had it on a time where we weren't going to be doing like a new segment, like as a pre-record, because we got to actually take a rare occasion. We got to actually pretty much take a full hour to actually just dive in. And there was more than an hour of great content to be created out of that. So we'll drag them back.
Absolutely. Well. You know what we should have done? We should have just kept on going and going and going until they noticed that we'd had them on for like 2 or 3 hours and then just made a whole bunch of shows out of it. That's what we should have done. Because it was one of those conversations, and I can't wait to play it next week. If anybody wants to load up a podcast for travel during Thanksgiving, I dare say that's one of the ones you want to put on your playlist, because it was a good conversation. There's a lot of stuff to get out of that report.
Exactly, and you can call it work and drown out the relatives you might want to be not listening to. So you know.
Although, since you're in the SEO world and, you know, there is no such thing as a vacation for SEOs. I mean, you're not allowed. Just accept it. Mm-hmm. Just it has always been thus. Things that don't age well, SEOs, just because we never get vacations. And tweets about aspects of SEO, such as whether we're going to have a core update soon or not. Did you see that? Yeah, this is really funny. On November 16th, SEO James Dodd tweets to John Mueller asking, you know, is there going to be a core update in before Christmas or in 2021, or can we relax? Mueller writes this really long thing back about how, you know, sometimes they have one scheduled and they don't release it like up until an hour beforehand. They don't launch it, or they don't even announce it, and sometimes it just gets launched. And then he puts TLDR, too long, didn't read. I don't know. Predictably or unpredictably, I don't know how you want to look at it. 52 minutes later, Google Central, I guess the other side of the office, the one that John's not sitting on, announces core updates happening.
Yeah.
So the right side of the office or the left side of the office. Anyway, so we are, there's a core update going on and people are talking about volatility in the search results. I'm seeing limited volatility, but it's out there. Another core update. What?
Yeah, I know. And on the, you know what? I'll say it the way they want me to say it. The SEMrush sensors, I hate it. Kind of, I think it, I'm going to have an itch and a bit of a rash from just having had to say it that way. But the SEMrush sensors are going nuts right now, showing incredibly high volatility. And I've got to say, on like, of course, first thing I did this morning, checked all of the daily ranking reports. and yeah, it's going nutty. Like I've had to have a few, you know, send out a few like little messages to people going, don't panic, you know, in either direction, or don't pop the cork on that champagne, right? Like this isn't a thing that you need to be doing. You know, it's, I guess, interestingly, you don't seem to have had it impact the people you are directly working with. The people, even ones that I'm not actually working with right now, but, you know, I still like run from ranking reports if I got like room in my metrics to like keep running them on like different types of campaigns that I might have worked on historically. And I'm seeing quite a degree of volatility. Like, I'm not talking like, wow, they went from position three to page three sort of levels of volatility, but I'm seeing volatility across a large number of keywords, only a couple positions in most cases, sometimes up, sometimes down, but significant change when I look at the breadth of keywords impacted. So it's really, really the last two, like the two in the summer, like hardly a whisper, but this one is at least for the site types that I'm monitoring, it is more severe. And I don't mean severe is necessarily bad, but it is certainly more impactful.
More impactful, sure. Yeah. Now, for what it's worth, this may or may not have an impact on how this core update is rolling out, but this is, we know it's rolling live, so it's not done yet. These are the early hours. It just started rolling out in the last, 24 to 36 hours. Mm-hmm. And we know Google is like a massive, like the world's largest water balancing machine. A little bit of, little couple drops go into here and it sets everything off balance over there and it's got to rebalance. And the volatility could go on for a couple of days, but as you were saying, Dave, like a sudden surge or a sudden drop doesn't mean you've fallen off the cliff or risen to the heavens. You might settle out somewhere in the middle when it's all done.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I just to pass some sympathy to people who are or not sympathy, but go, it's okay. We all do it to people who might have been impacted, either good or bad. But this is usually your instinct when you see some negative things, especially, and we've all been there, 2/3 of things are up, 1/3 are down, and your eye is immediately drawn to the red and you're like, what's going wrong? It's like, no, you're more up than down. But even after I've been doing this, 20 years, something like that, or something heading into the 20 year mark at this point, and I still cannot help myself, like 12 hours in, seeing ranking reports and going, what do I need to fix? It's like, nothing, just stop. Like, there's nothing to do right now. They say, like, this thing might take a week or two to roll out, like, completely. And then, as you say, the balancing act that's going to come after that, just chill.
Let or just keep yourself out. Just keep doing your work. Improve title tags, improve the content. Make sure that there's, like, a clear path from concept A to purchase decision now, make a clear link, make a clear link path so that you can get from point A to point B, D, and C in the website, make it easy for the user to use the site and Google to understand what's going on, and just keep on doing that. Yeah.
Now, one thing I do think you can get early on, and do not act on it, folks. And I try and like hold myself back on acting on it as well. But one of the things I do find interesting to look at very early on is, because that pendulum does sort of settle in the middle, right? That sort of like water balancing act that you were talking about earlier, because it does sort of seem to settle in the middle, it usually does come much more aggressively in the first wave. I do find this an interesting time. And if you have like daily ranking reports running or something like that, you can go back and look at this like over the weekend or something, which is when I'll be doing it. But if you look at that first wave, you can often get some insights into what are they trying to do? Because by the time they do settle, it might be a little more subtle, a little more gray, the areas they were trying to impact. Whereas that first wave before they've done their corrections can sometimes, not all the time, maybe not even most of the time, but can sometimes be a little more telling in the areas that they're trying to address, or the types of keywords and the clusters of them that might be impacted. So just something for listeners to go, you might want to look at the 24-hour. Don't act on it. There's nothing to act on, but it might be something to look at even after the fact when things do settle and go, what were they trying to do? Here's where they ended up, assuming that you have a system where you can go back and look at previous
frames. Track it. Makes nice graphs.
Yeah, track it. It makes nice graphs.
Now, I do got a problem here, and that maybe you guys can help me out with this. I don't know. Actually, I know what I'm gonna do, but I got like two fairly major websites that are just about to go into migration. They're waiting for Black Friday / Cyber Monday, and after that, e-commerce web traffic may as well just drop off because the post office ain't getting it there by Christmas. Right. So if you're going to be doing your migration, start looking into December. This is a good time to start planning and then start getting the ball rolling. And right now is when I'm taking my very final measurements of mm-hmm. the website. Mm-hmm. I should have done it last week. Yeah. Damn it. Now, luckily you can go back and set the dates and get the analytics from those periods. But yeah. I have to do that extra step now because I didn't do it last week. And yeah. These are large sites, so there's a lot of information to gather.
Well, and this is why I think Google should always give us a week's notice on every update.
That's right. And at least they should give John and Danny an hour's update. That would be polite.
Yeah, I think I don't know if they were kind of like trying to throw John under the bus there. I don't know what was going on.
No, you know what? It's like John said in the tweet that the long tweet he originally sent back. These things happen. The engineers plan this stuff out, and sometimes just before launching, they decide not to, and sometimes it all happens very, very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. So. Google's trying to accomplish something. What they're trying to accomplish is anybody's guess. It'll probably make them money. And there you go. Mm-hmm. So one thing they might be trying to accomplish, this just occurred to me. Did you the translated search? Happening, especially what's happening in India?
Yeah. What do you think? I love it.
I love it. I love it in intent. I think mm-hmm. it's wonderful intent. So just so the listeners know, Google is taking search results, and mostly everything is phrased in English in Google SERPs, even in places where English isn't the predominant language. English is the predominant language of the web, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily the predominant language everywhere the web is. So say you're in India and you speak Hindi, but everything is in English. You obviously have a working knowledge of English, but it would be so much easier to understand if everything was in Hindi. So Google will now deliver search results to you, translated. The title and the meta description will be translated into the dominant language of the area that you're at, or the language that you have set. And if you click on those results, you will then go through Google Translate's filter, and the websites and all that stuff will also come up in those languages. Mm-hmm. And again, the intent of this is wonderful. I think this is what the internet should do.
You're right.
but have you seen Google Translate? Wars are started over this kind of sloppiness.
Yeah, it's got two core. Okay, there's got big problems. I mean, one is you're right. Like Google Translate isn't good. And I think one of the problems you're right. It is actually quite good for what it is, but it leaves something to be desired. And when you're clicking on a title and description that might indicate, hey, you're about to find what you want because it is in your language, you may infer when you land somewhere else that it might give you a false optimism on the grammar level that you're about and the accuracy of the translation that you're about to land at just because you were presented with your chosen language. Then there's some actual technical problems in that I deal with. And you know, it's you know, somebody I can name here. But I work with a company, Weights and Biases, right? In the machine learning space. And there's plenty of them. I mean, think Stack Exchange, right? Like, I mean, you can think anybody in the tech space. We have the no translate, which Google is respecting in regards to this. They said they respect it. Well, there's some technical reasons, just because of the build of the site. But there's also the reason that we're using code samples. And if you try to translate like a code sample, which tends to be in English, like code tends to have English install, right? Tends to be in English. You can't just translate that and have it still work, you know, when you launch Visual Studio and, you know, open up to edit in Python or whatever, right? Like you can't just drop this code in, translate it and have it work. So we have to have no translate in there. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden that's not going to work. So it's going to break in some edge cases. Now there's some little workarounds to that.
You can opt out of translated SERPs.
Yes.
And if your SERP result is not translated, then there's no filter to trigger.
Right.
So the page itself. Also, there's got to be a way you could still have a translated page, but introduce that code snippet inside of an object of some sort that wasn't subject to translate. There's got to be some method.
Absolutely. There actually is. You can go through like tags and stuff and you go, oh, okay, in this span, no translate, like these spans. It wouldn't work for something like comments or whatnot. In our case, there are a couple other technical reasons why we just have to apply it universally to pages because things just sort of like break. But that's more unique to like, I'm not going, Google should change everything just for us. that's not what they should do, but there are going to be some edge cases where it doesn't work. And another area where I think will cause problems, is in anything that requires a high level of sort of skill and authority, right? Where having where just the nuances of something being translated might be lost. I'm thinking of areas like health and things like that, where it needs to be 100%, right? Like there's a reason why, like YMYL sites are under like such scrutiny when it comes to like the quality raters and algorithms revolving just around them. So I do wonder how this will apply to them, where if all of a sudden you take some English content and translate it into Korean and then drop it on them, but it's trying to give health advice, where might things be lost that actually causes damage, right? Like that actually hurts people.
I'm thinking somewhere between hand and mouth.
Right.
Yeah, that's really scary, actually. Somebody should note that and run searches through Translate just to see what comes up and how.
Yeah, and is there a nuance? Because there are just weird things. Like, I don't even know the weird things about English until I'm talking to somebody who isn't English as a first language. And they're like, what did you mean by that? And I'm like, oh, yeah, that did not at all mean how it comes across literally. And I do wonder in technical, in finances, in health, where do we drop those? It just, they don't translate well. It makes perfect sense to us, but we just use words weird, and it's okay. So does everybody else, but we all use them a different weird.
English being the mutt language that it is, the amalgam of everything, with invented words coming into the lexicon, like, I don't know, as quickly as videos get launched up on YouTube.
Yeah.
So you can get confusing quickly. There ought to be a thumbs up and thumbs down button for words, eh?
Nice segue.
Thanks. And if you got it, yeah, and if you have YouTube videos, you might not find those a thumbs down. So yeah, they're removing the thumbs down button from YouTube videos. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of neat. I think it's a weird one. In one way, I think it's really good. In another way, I get where YouTube co-founder Jared Karim comes from, where he's saying this will destroy the platform.
Yeah, I think that's not
a bit much. Yeah, YouTube is fairly substantial.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
I think it's more than a fad. There's countless millions of videos are uploaded every day. Like, that's phenomenal. And the founder, Jared, is saying people need a way to discern whether this is good content or bad content. My problem with YouTube is people aren't able to discern what is factual and non-factual content, much less what's good or bad. I don't know if a thumbs up or thumbs up button really helps with that, though.
No, and the thing is, like, instinctively, I like this. Like, I get, I mean, obviously, he's an authority on it, right? Like, he's one of the founders. So, like, I get it. And it's not just him. It's not just, like, one lone person. There are other people saying that this, it does serve a benefit. I personally, and after watching, you know, the like, misuse of the angry and ha-has, like the ha-ha actually becoming more just like this passive-aggressive douchebaggery reaction in most cases on Facebook. You know, the misuse of those, I actually quite like it. And how often have you, and I'm sure a lot of people have, landed at a YouTube video and you're just sort of watching it? I don't know. It could boil down to something as simple as, you know, you're watching like a video from, I don't know, Jim, you and I are about the same age, right? You're watching some, like, it's the actual video from like some like 1980s band, right? Like, and it's got all these thumbed down. And it's like, no, you don't get to do that, right? Like, that's not appropriate here. You shouldn't have been here if this isn't what you wanted to see. You know, or something just inert like that. Like, I'm just listing like these like examples that I keep
reportage
hitting.
Reportage like, of a historic event getting thumbed down.
Exactly. I've seen like walkthroughs of like tech reviews, right? I was looking up a keyboard that I just bought, but I was looking up reviews and I'm like, no, this is like just some guy's review. Like, and it was like pretty good. Like, it wasn't like a crappy review. I'm like, you might not like the keyboard, but it is what it is. You know, so I actually like it being pulled out. I think having something there that allowed a user to define for themselves, like basically send to Google a signal going, don't like this stuff. I think that aspect of a thumbs down would be good. It's the count that I find kind of annoying. Like, letting people thumbs down and going, yeah, just send a signal to us that you don't like this kind of stuff, and then we'll just make sure you don't get it because it doesn't apply to you. No problem. And in fact, I have a feeling some people might even be using it as that function. They're going in there going, don't want to see this, where it's not actually as much a judgment of that video as going, I need to signal I don't like stuff like this. Like, this doesn't apply to me.
It's ideological or political. It doesn't have anything to do with the veracity of the content, quality of the content, or the usefulness of it. It's just because they don't like it.
I don't like it. And I could see myself doing it if it's like, no, you just, I've landed at this video. It's ranking for a thing that maybe it shouldn't, as far as like getting served to me. You know, so should I let the system know I, as Dave, don't care for this kind of video? Sure. Right. But having that thumbs down button would be beneficial in my opinion, but without the count. Like, there is no,
I totally get what you're saying. Yeah. There's no reason to pump it up if it's not being counted. But if it benefits you in the way the algorithm sorts stuff, then you're sending them a signal that is beneficial to your content usage in the future. My problem with it, and I've always had this problem with user recommendations and stars, and it's the wisdom of the crowd is great when you're polling, but the crowd is really emotional and they don't really think about stuff. They just react on stuff. And you now see businesses getting pushed around with star reviews. I had this one client who the reviews in Google.com or in Google Local, forget what they're calling it now. It was Google My Business. Now it's Google In My Business or something. But the star reviews, they were getting totally pushed around by clients because they were so scared of getting a low review. So clients would give them a low review and then force them into negotiations so they would change their review. Right. That's abusive. Right. It's too simplistic a system, and it's way open to abuse. And people are just so mean on the internet that giving them this extra tool, as you said, of douchebaggery, it's like, I don't know. Like, at the same time, I can completely understand why it would be a useful tool to help suggest this is and is not a good video. Maybe, again, as you said, taking away the endorphin rush of it, of being of it being a visible vote.
Right. It's not a mob thing you can like get behind. It's just something you can use as a tool to adjust what you have displayed to you.
Thing is, as the web develops, especially in areas like e-commerce and self-entertainment, like YouTube, these tools are going to be more and more used, more and more important, and have a greater role in how recommendation engines produce content from one website or another website or another website. Look at what like things like Trivago do, the travel app, or Expedia. By spidering every other travel app out there and using a whole wealth of data sets to, I don't know, figure out the optimal packages to offer the user, I think we're going to be seeing that in e-commerce in the future, especially if we move into a metaverse where things are represented in some physical representation or some quasi-physical. We'll have to be drawing from a bunch of different sources to make those spaces, especially if it's like entrepreneurial and not owned by Amazon. So long and short of it, these ratings tools are going to be used more and more frequently and have a greater effect on how algorithms see objects. We really should think about them being more simplistic than thumbs up and thumbs down.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay.
Now I'm going to segue us because it relates to something you were talking about there. And it was the Google Business Profile. And a story that, your friend of mine, Mr. Mike Blumenthal. Dude knows stuff about everything
Google. He is the local SEO local.
And he caught an interesting insight that I hadn't noticed in going over there, where Google is actually using it. I'm glad they took the don't be evil off, because this is just bad. If you went over to your Google My Business profile, good catch, Mike, hat tip to you, and you click through, one of the things that it lists, like it all of a sudden has some like little panels where, like, if you're a manager, you logged in, it has like little information bubbles. Keep your customers up to date. Claim your Google Ads credit. Right? That sort of stuff appears there. Mm-hmm. One of them was new laws may impact your business, that takes you to their antitrust, like their spin on antitrust legislation that's going on and stuff. Like, basically, they've just made it their political spin location.
Okay, so what is this button? You push this button, what does it do?
It just takes you to another page. Like, it's not a button for, like, it's a button, or it's a carousel that takes you to additional information, or okay, like additional pages on their site.
So Google gives you its quote unquote grassroots spin on freedom of entrepreneurial enterprise and making money on the web.
Yeah, exactly. And when you go to that page, it has the cost of making it harder for customers to find you. Basically, their spin on why you should just let them keep going uninterrupted in just taking over the whole, like, every ecosystem that they want. Not getting into the debate, should they or shouldn't they? Because that part's not really like, that's not what we're, this part is sort of talking about, right? Like, we can get into that, but we can have whole shows and there's people who specialize in like antitrust lawsuits and stuff like that. And the pros and cons of like, if we stop them, who's going to do that, right? Like,
but this is a sneaky way of introducing this idea.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This is not how this should be done or the place for it. That is not what the business owner is there to do. And you're catching, I mean, admittedly, you're catching a very targeted group of small business owners, sometimes bigger business owners, but bigger business owners are going to tend to have agencies doing this. So you're going to catch a lot of small business owners who are just going to go, oh, making it harder for customers to find me. That's horrible. I hate that. Right? Like, and fair enough. They should, if you're being told that customers aren't going to be able to find you without actually being able to like dive further into it. Like, you and I talk about this all the time. A lot of our listeners are like listening to podcasts like ours. They'll have some additional insight, at least as far as going, I know whatever Google's telling me isn't 100% true, right? Like, you may not even know the full story, but you know that we're all marketers. This is a spin, right? Like, yeah, they're trying to be able to get away with everything. That's their job. I don't blame them. But this is not the right place. I appreciated Mike catching it, sharing it, because I hadn't noticed it before he had shared it. Mm-hmm. I was able to duplicate what he's seeing though. So and for everybody, you can go to nearmedia.co. And Mike's piece is over there, and you can see exactly what we're talking about here. And don't be evil went by the wayside.
Well, I mean, don't be evil went by the wayside shortly after they wrote their first IPO documents telling everybody how they were going to do everything different and not be evil, right?
Right. Yeah, that's accurate. Yep.
And that's around the same time that they started giving up the ghost on pretty much everything that they were trying to protect, such as privacy. And at the same time, taking data and information away from folks like us, all in the name of greater privacy, of course. But this is around the time when they're introducing the remarkably prescient and present Chrome browser, which is, you know, the Chrome browser is pretty much everywhere you go. Even if you're not using it, the Chrome browser is still there. Mm-hmm. And you're in incognito mode on the Chrome browser. And that's your Google. Yeah. You know, I don't even know who's there, but there's a lot of folks there. So that's between you, all those midgets, those naked midgets, and everybody else watching you, including... Edward Snowden, who isn't watching you directly, but is watching over you in this beneficial sort of critical way. He came out the other day and went to town on Google and Danny Sullivan about privacy, people's privacy rights.
I loved him. Like, watching that. Nope, I mean you. Like, that's the statement. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, just calling him out there. He actually hits on some things I'd never really thought of before. Mm-hmm. As some big concerns, like calling it, and it is hostile from the standpoint of privacy, like scripts required CAPTCHAs for certain things. And it's like, oh, right, you're requiring me to become visible to you for this thing, right? Like, you're requiring that me to let you run scripts, requiring, you know, page redirect, like require basically a bunch of things. What I loved about that conversation was him sort of like, listing off that search results are garbage, like that I thought was funny. But then Danny coming in and going, I think he's talking about site search. And then his response, you just like, I just had to love it, right? No, I definitely mean search engines, and Google is the worst. It's just like, all right, you know, just calling a spade a spade. Now, he's clearly not saying buy results. Google does a fantastic job there. But when, and I'll get to canaries in a minute here, because that's part of like a different story, but he is acting sort of like a handy little canary in the coal mine, in going, there are things we don't see about privacy concerns. And it does take somebody like Edward Snowden, like people who like know what to look out for on stuff like this. Cause I hadn't actually thought of, like, I hit the reCAPTCHA. I've always sort of like jokingly thought of it as, I'm a machine learning person because I'm here training the machine how to recognize, you know, what a fire hydrant is, right? Or whatnot every time I see one. But right, like this is actually built on the fact that I'm willing to share my data, right? It's just, it's built on that. I have to allow all these scripts to run for this to happen. I have a choice to do that. I don't have to. I don't have to use Google, but well, I'm an SEO. I don't have a choice. But
indeed.
But I chose this profession and I knew that. But I think he brings up a lot of good points. And I hope the folks at Google pay a bit of attention to that, because I think a lot of the things they need to accomplish could be accomplished without maybe the same privacy violations. I might be wrong. But I would hope it's something that they consider when somebody like Edward Snowden comes forward and points out some of the things, so that we're talking about it on a podcast, right? Does it just go by the wayside, or do we actually keep caring?
Yeah, it really, really, really depends how you want the web to work, I'd imagine. I am so not an expert in this, but I am an expert in public policy, and I can tell you it takes a great deal of individual data to run a city.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a huge amount of individual data to run a health system. If you want service to match up magically with implementation need and expense and costs, then we need to really think about what privacy means in public systems, and we need to think about the hardness and the effectiveness of closed systems, like the health system. Like there was a hospital in, I think, London, Ontario, or Kitchener, Ontario, that was ransomwared recently. And in the attack, data on X number of patients. And in Canada, the provincial ministries of health collect a huge amount of data on us that was all available through this system, and that's all been leaked. So to provide a strong healthcare service, we need to have and share that data.
Mm-hmm.
But there's massive privacy concerns about having and sharing that data. For instance, our capability of what we can do with data far exceeds the care we take in securing it.
Right.
And so hackers get in, and, like, you know, now the insurance companies know that Joe Smith over in London, Ontario's got cancer. And he's probably not a good bet for insurance right now. That sucks.
Right. Yeah.
Now, this is a little bit different than Google tracking you, but it's not. Google can tell what diseases you have by the searches you do. Absolutely, Google can tell what's going on with you by searches that you do.
And I've seen it pointed out, and I'll just point it out to our listening audience. But by the searches you do, you don't actually find out what you have. Actually, you find out what was SEO'd best.
That is often true. Meanwhile, the machine is still hoovering up so much information that you're giving it about yourself. Yeah. And we're trusting. And you know what? I'm 53 years old, and so far, all that's helped me. I don't think it's hurt me, but I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I have a premium that's higher than it should be. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah, privacy is something we really need to think about in the coming years. We are, again, we're going to, I hate to throw the, I want to find a different term than metaverse. I don't like the term metaverse because it's now Zuckerberg's term.
Yeah, it was a good term until a couple weeks ago.
But if we are entering a holographic web, we really, 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 really have to, could you imagine privacy concerns on a holographic web? We need to tie that avatar back to you as a person.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a huge field moving forward. If anyone interested in law, check privacy as a field of law. You will be employed forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think they can AI that.
I'll probably be surprised, but not soon anyway.
Indeed. Okay. I think we've flogged that one pretty well. What we're really trying to do is get Edward Snowden to tweet us so that he comes on the show.
That'd be great.
That would be. It was really cool. We know that Snowden is monitoring Barry Schwartz. We know this for a fact.
Yeah.
So we're going to get him. I don't know how, but we're going to get him.
Yeah. Maybe we'll get Barry and Edward on the same show.
That would be pretty cool, but it would also kind of cause a meltdown from you and me, because I admire them both strongly. I mean, like, what do you do there, right?
Yeah, let's pull Danny on too, just to make it Danny Sullivan, just to make it.
Indeed. Okay. What do you think of the Google SEO? Have you seen it? The interactive SEO checklist?
Yeah, I liked it. When I saw it, I started playing around with some different configurations. I'm like, you know, it's very googly. Like, they're not giving you any, you know, great insights if you're somebody, you know, like you or me, right? Like people who've been around for a while and we already know this stuff. But what I did like about it is it covers some things that might not be intuitive for lots of beginners, but like I always just try and think of a business owner who doesn't have an SEO. Yeah. Like, what can they do? And it provided some good, solid advice when I look at it from that standpoint. And I actually bookmarked it because I'm like, you know, it might be something to like once a year use and just go, did you dot all your I's, Dave? Did you pay attention to each of these areas? I may not have to read all the articles to remember what's in each one and what I should be doing. But it's like I use those like checklists occasionally, like an audit checklist. Like I know all the stuff that's on them most of the time. Sometimes I see stuff that surprises me still where I'm like, oh yeah, that's a good point. But it's just like don't skip this thing, right? Like just dot that I, make sure you're ruling. I mean, you and I've talked about that on the show before. Like 80% of the job is just making sure you've dotted all the I's so you don't have to care about stuff, 90% of which never would have had any impact at all, but you just need to know. You need to know that it's not this stuff. So if something goes right or wrong, you can attribute it to the areas that are remaining. I liked it. What did you think?
Well, when I first heard that the checklist was being published, I thought it was part of the you know, the conspiracy out there that Google is conspiring to put SEOs out of business.
Right.
And then I started using it, started going through it for the developer, the business owner's perspective, the developer's perspective, and the SEO's perspective. And then just for the audience who hasn't seen it yet, it gives you different things you might be thinking about if you're a business owner, if you're a dev, or if you're a professional SEO. I'm going to use it as a training tool, to be honest. I don't think it's part of Google's attempt to flush SEOs out of the business. In fact, I think it shows how it helps demonstrate in a real simple way how incredibly complicated SEO is. I'm doing an audit for another client who just launched a new website relaunched their website on a new platform. Mm-hmm. And the data points I'm touching on are like, it's incredible the number of data points you need to touch on when you're doing a high level audit. And this is a really important client for me. Like if I'm doing the extra mile and then some. Mm-hmm. Tools like Google just published the SEO checklist. Again, just shows how incredibly complicated all the number of different things and different ways you got to think when you're acting as an SEO.
Yeah.
One thing I always used, I still believe that SEOs should know HTML. I do agree with John Mueller that it's becoming so much easier to make a website that you don't need to know HTML to make a website. But if you want to understand how the web works, you need to know the basic foundational language of the web.
Yeah.
I would think.
I absolutely agree. I think just understanding, if nothing else, I think it helps you have conversations with developers at a better level. Like you, like I was actually on with one this there morning and I'm like, I can't possibly understand everything, but it helps me at least get a gist of how to present something to them as a problem.
Well, and why this process should work when you think about it from inception to implementation to outcome, why this works like this. We need to know how the machine goes.
Yeah.
That's something that Google can't teach people.
Right.
There's no way Google can use a automated checklist to put a really experienced SEO out of business, because the SEO has been gathering information about how all of this stuff works together for years and years and years and years. So I'm going to use this as a training tool. I'm going to train my clients. by having them go through this. And this is what I have to think about. Here's what I want you thinking about, so we can think about this together and I can make better decisions.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's a great tool. Actually, it's funny. I'm like, oh, I should probably send this to a few people I know.
Because you know what? I'm pretty sure that if I can coax a client to actually go through it, they'll call me and they'll have a much more reasonable conversation with me about this, that, or whatnot afterwards.
Right. Yeah.
For instance, what if you have to go to the client and say, look, you need to redevelop your logo because it doesn't look good on a white background. And, you know, those schema guys, right? You know.
Another great segue, Jim.
Yeah. Well, you see, you should just be able to say that to your client, just that alone. And they'll go, oh, yeah, I got it, man. I'm sending that out to the developers right now. But no, you have to go through this whole long conversation about what schema is, that you're not talking dirty to them. That's the hardest part. And then, you know, well, it depends on the client you have, right? And then you have to, you know, explain what the fix is. If the client knew already, she'd be able to say, hey, the schema's not right on this one. And it doesn't look good on a white background. Got to get fixed. Because as it turns out, there is a new directive for schema saying that schema for logos will only be effective if the logo renders well on a white background. And I think this is probably from all those guys at Schema and their side jobs as web developers when they go to Google Images and they try to snag a image or a logo image and it always comes out black on white. And they're just so frustrated, so they put this rule in.
And thank you. it's interesting because it makes perfect sense. Like when you think of how they use images like themselves, and the example that Barry had put in to his article, right? Like it makes like they're showing it in a knowledge panel, and yeah, like it's on a white background. It needs to look good on a white background. I had originally, like when I first saw the title, was like, oh, this is a horrible idea. Like I was thinking, oh, it needs to have a white background. And that's like my brain just had a hiccup in understanding what they were meaning for a second there. Then went, oh no, it doesn't have to have a white background. It can be a great big, like it can be what it is meant to be just as long as it renders well on a white background. I'm like, yeah, no, that makes good sense. It may require people to actually come up with a different logo. To feed, however, like I can think of if I had a website with a black background, then my logo might actually just be like a brightly colored, sort of vector image, sort of logo with a transparent background, because my site itself has a black header or something like that. And if you actually just use that, as soon as it's put on white, it's going to be this like very lightly colored, sort of logo once you put it on a white background. So now you're just gonna have to take your logo, put it on a black, put it in a black square or whatever the shape of your logo would be, and sort of drop it on to the background that it should have and use that in your schema. I think it makes a lot of sense from Google's standpoint. And yeah, I think a good thing for people to be aware of. And it's a shame that only people that listen to our show or pay attention to these. I mean, it's not just on our show, right? But like pay attention to these things on search engine land or through Google themselves. Get to know that, because most people don't.
Yep. Most people can't use schema in a sentence without laughing.
Right. Valid point.
Okay. Have you seen, I mentioned that I was, doing a fairly massive audit for an important client. And so I've been spending a lot of time, half of yesterday to be precise, in the new PageSpeed Insight tool. You been there yet?
I have. In fact, I was just there this morning.
It's pretty freaking cool.
It is.
Seriously.
Yeah.
It's faster, clearer, better actionable insights, which incidentally is really easily portable to an Excel file. I'm very pleased with the changes that were made at PageSpeed Insights, including new information on the data collection period, on visit durations, on devices used when the assessment or the when the assessment by PageSpeed was made, Yeah, I think it's just the information they're giving makes decision making easier.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And you know, on top of Page Speed Insights, like that's everybody's go-to, right? Like Page Speed Insights to check these things. But I promised earlier, or I referenced earlier, that I would be talking about canaries again because Edward Snowden acts as a canary. Lighthouse 9.1, which is the version of Lighthouse that is used with Page Speed Insights, is also available. And I can't, it's one of those like, did not know. I don't know why I didn't know this existed, but you can download Google Canary. It's a beta format of Google Chrome. So you can download it off of Search Engine Land's article has a link to it, or you can just Google Chrome Canary and download it. It's also being used through Lighthouse in the dev tools there. So you can also use it.
Slow down here. Canary is the testing Chrome, basically.
Yeah.
That's the environment in which Google runs stuff against.
Yes, and the next stable release of Chrome, when it comes out in version 98, will also have this. But for right now, if you wanted it through Chrome, you would need to use Chrome Canary, which I'm now using.
Wow, I did not know. Today I learned.
Okay, perfect. See, because I felt like kind of an idiot. I'm like, am I the only person that doesn't know about this?
No, I'm ashamed of myself. I didn't know this, but I'm actually really bugged that I'm not using it.
Yeah, like some of the perks that they list on the pages is updated nightly, so it's not like the same version things. But some handy uses. One of them is listed right there is develop websites for the next version of the web. I'm like, yeah, that is great. Like when you're working on your website, test it in that because that's the version that's going to be coming up.
Well, so
if you're a developer. So if you're a developer, that's just absolutely like a great version to have. So anyway.
So that's called Google Canary. Aptly named.
Yeah.
How long has Google had a Canary version of Chrome that has been the test bed that most people haven't been using?
I have no idea. I only found out about it like 3 hours ago or something when I like read that. I'm like, what? Okay. And off I went to it. Clearly Barry knew about it, but I didn't.
Well, Barry knows everything.
I know. He probably like talked about it when it like launched. So, and I just like happened to have missed that day because I took a day off and he never does.
Indeed. How stable is it? That's my last question about this.
There is a warning that it is like it's not. It is like right there. There's like a checkbox basically going, this might crash. It can be unstable. And to sign up for this, your crash reports are going to go to them. Like, because that's what it's there for. It's to act as Google's canary. Yeah.
Run that in incognito mode, I dare you.
Yeah, I don't know what Edward Snowden would say about it, except that Edward Snowden would have to go like, yeah, it tells you right there. Like, this is big front and center. It's like, we're going to be like sending usage statistics back because we need to know this. That's what it's for. But yeah, I think it's really, really handy. If I was a developer, I'd be all over this. And like I'm an SEO and I'm all over it because I think it's a super handy right now. I got it because yeah, it has some different, page speed stuff in there and Lighthouse versions. But, I do like the idea of sort of knowing, seeing sites as they will be seen in the next version. Not to say now as a warning to folks, if you do decide to download it and use it, if things look horrible in Canary and they don't look horrible in normal Chrome, also understanding that this is the canary for Google. It's not to say that the next version of Chrome is necessarily going to break your site because they might be fixing stuff. That's why they're collecting this data.
So if Canary only sees like 29 of your 30 pages, it might think that you're an authoritative site or something.
Right.
Okay. Did you see that? This is our dumb news of the week. We're getting near the end of the show, and this is the dumb one I saw. Somebody, I don't know who it was. I think it might have been Gary or John Mueller who published just a number, and he didn't mean anything by the number. It was just a number. He said you might want to have more than 30 pages in your website for us to consider you authoritative. And I think he was being a smart ass. And again, he was saying like 30 isn't really a huge, I mean, 30 is nothing on a website, right? It's that's a brochure website.
Yeah.
And that's what he was saying. If you're a brochure website, you're probably not the authority on any given topic. And somehow in the telephone game that we call SEO forums, that became a standard. You must have 30 plus pages to be considered authoritative. That's not how it works. he was just saying a number. It didn't mean 30 and that's the metric. And then beyond that, all goes. He didn't mean that.
No. And I mean, realistically, I can be authoritative with five pages if the authority I want is for Oregano's Pizza, Victoria, BC. There's one. I will be the authority on that. sort of thing. But this is why I feel sorry for John. So John has people taking him way out of context and just on like a off the cuff sort of statement that was meant to serve like as an example of like a low level page count. He could have said 20. He could have said 50, depending on the competition level. And then he's got Google throwing him under the bus with updates like minutes after he said that he didn't know if one would be rolling out. And then they throw it at him. I feel sorry for John.
There might be a fellowship at CERN or something. You know, no, that's just I hope that gets struck from the podcast. To be honest, I wish I had said that one. Because people take what we say seriously, and they should, except when we say we say stuff like that.
Catch.
Everything should be taken seriously except stuff like that.
Exactly.
Okay, we got time for one more. And then we've gone full clock. I'm not sure where to go, though. I'm not sure if we have any more stories.
Well, I like, I think you had shared it, the XML sitemaps, or do you have one?
Oh, that's right. That's the other story. This one is actually good. I'm not sure if it's dumb or not. I thought it was sort of. So if you have an old XML sitemap, you're doing a migration or you move a website over something, you have an old XML sitemap. Mm-hmm. And you have new sitemaps. You've got a new site and a new structure and everything, and you've published a new sitemap and everything. It's a smart thing to do. Your old sitemap is not going to help you. In fact, it's often pointing to resources that don't exist anymore and forcing Google to go through a 301 to find the resource that does exist now. Mm-hmm. And so John Mueller put something up on Twitter the other day. He was asked about the efficacy of keeping an old sitemap existing and registered in Search Console. And I don't even know where that came from originally, but I erase them. I kill them and then just rely on the new thing, because Google uses the sitemap for discovery, not for any real crawling purposes. So I don't see the point to trying to drive Googlebot with an old sitemap. That just seems silly to me.
You know, it's interesting, because back in 2019, John caused his own problem with this one.
You know where this came from?
I only know the date because I was dealing with a client and actually put up a sitemap exactly for this reason. And it was, he had noted to the putting up a temporary, as he's calling it here, temporary is fine, a temporary sitemap to tell Google to visit pages that have moved. Like if you're doing a domain migration, which was the scenario he was talking about there, we'd done a domain migration. Google was having problems hanging on to the old one, and it wasn't locking onto the new one. It was like holding the old pages. So we just submitted the sitemap to sort of shake the tree and go, come back, here's the pages that you need to visit on the old one. And it did seem to speed up the dropping of the old pages. But that is absolutely anecdotal at this point. Like, it served me. John had answered that question that it could be used for that purpose, which he actually wasn't answering me. It was just funny that he happened to answer that question a week before I hit the problem, which was just like a funny timing. And that's why I remember the year. So he might have caused that, but outside of that one very, very limited use, I can't see why he would. Absolutely, like you, Googlebot, and Googlebot's a lot smarter now than it was back then too. So,
put up fresh sitemaps, put up ones that deliver Googlebot to accurate URLs. That I think that's helpful to a degree. I don't think Google relies on the sitemap that the way it used to. Mm-hmm. Now, sitemaps used to be like really important. And to this day, I do believe Mueller when he says that Google sees the existence of a sitemap or of a hierarchy of sitemaps as a mark of web quality. Mm-hmm. I do believe that, although I don't know how much Google needs the actual XML feed to figure out a website, but it is helpful. So, okay. Lastly, if you see the number of references to AMP pages coming from Twitter decreasing radically, it's because they've decreased radically. Twitter is no longer defaulting to AMP pages. It's no longer supporting AMP. And many publishers are doing the same. AMP is a dying format.
Yep.
Thank God. Thank goodness. I'm glad.
I hated it. I'm relieved too.
Okay. We have gone full clock. We're 30 seconds away from the end of show. So on behalf of Dave Davies from Beanstalk Internet Marketing, this is Jim Hedge from Digital East Media. We're reminding people to please go get vaccinated against COVID. Protect yourselves, especially moving into a holiday travel period. Be safe. Wear masks. Travel safely and congregate with your families and loved ones safely. We're not going to be here next week, but we will have a amazing interview with the guys from SEO Clarity, Middle and Mark, talking about the click-through rate study. Tune in, grab the podcast, listen to that episode. It's a lot of fun and there's great information in it. In the meantime, happy Thanksgiving. We're grateful for you. Travel safely, be well, love each other, stay safe. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
The opinions expressed in this WMR.FM program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of WMR.FM. Any rebroadcast, republication, or retransmission of this program without proper consent is prohibited.